Last week, Steve, I could characterize it as a disservice because at the end of the service last week, he said to me, "So, are you doing the whole of chapter 19 next week?" And I said, "What are you thinking?" And he asked about the passage there right before what we read, where there's a master that sends out. Is going to collect a kingdom for himself, and he gives 3 months' wages, 4 months' wages to several 10 servants. And at the end, it's the last verse there, 19:27. It says, "As for my enemies who don't want me as their king, bring them here and slaughter them before me." And so Steve said, "What are you going to do with that passage?" And so that is almost like a dare in my fighting orientation. And anyway, so what I want to do is not really very, very typical of Palm Sunday sermons. And not that I do things that are typical of most sermons, but at any rate, Steve's question there, Steve Fannin's, prompted me to say to look at the whole of chapter 19, because Luke, as we said at the very beginning, as he says at the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, and repeats at the beginning of Acts. He says he deliberately sat down and considered all the sources, and he's brought these things, dear Theophilus, to you to convince you of the truth of Jesus. So Luke, in his entire writing, is making an argument. And I love to argue. I love to engage in the conversation. And so I look at it and I say that these stories, in all of these stories, Luke is arguing a number of different things. And the one that comes up here today is the question of, in a sense, what kind of king is Jesus? You know, here we use all these phrases, these terms to describe Jesus. But what does it mean? What does it really mean if Jesus is King of Kings, Lord of Lords? What is Luke arguing? And how does chapter 19 fit into that? Now, the first story in chapter 19 is Zacchaeus. We treated that last week. And Zacchaeus was, I said, he was at the top of a tax collector pyramid, right? But he was part of a much bigger pyramid. So he was a person of authority, but relatively limited authority within the Jericho district, right? But all these were priests and Levites. They were people who were relatively well off. And so he was probably a very well off person. And he supposedly climbs a sycamore. Chris isn't here, so I can say it's a sycamore fig and it has no lower branches. He challenged me, but his was a mulberry fig. It wasn't a sycamore, and it looked more like a crepe myrtle than anything else, or crepe myrtle. And anyway, the point of it is that this little robust, thick-bodied man is said to have climbed a tree with very few branches. And my point was, no, he barely made it up to the tree. He was not able to climb the tree. And Jesus saw him when he was the one who wanted to see Jesus. Jesus saw him. And immediately on seeing Jesus, he said, and Jesus inviting him, saying, I'm going to eat with you today. Zacchaeus, his life kind of falls together. And he says, you know, if I'm going to give half of everything to the poor, I'm going to, if anybody's been cheated, I'll repay them four times as much. And Jesus says, salvation has come to you, this household today. Turns out that's a pretty important phrase. Because what comes next? As they listen to this, Jesus told them another parable. He was near Jerusalem, so he's in Jericho. They're heading up towards Jerusalem. And it says, and they thought the kingdom would appear right away. So he's just finished saying Zacchaeus has committed himself to economic justice with his gains, right? His own wealth. Jesus says, salvation has come to his household today. Then the next thing he says, I'm going to tell a parable because these people are really thinking the end is near. So they're anticipating that Jesus is moving up to Jerusalem. And what is Jerusalem? You know, I have to go about 4 weeks back when I was talking about Jerusalem coming together as both a political and religious center. Remember? And so it was that story, Jericho or Jerusalem to Jericho Road, that whole piece. So Jerusalem is, if you're going to stage a coup, it's the equivalent of the mall and the Capitol building in this country. So if you're going to strike and take over, that's where you go. Same thing with Jerusalem. So Jesus is saying that these folks around me, they're all anticipating the coming of the kingdom. And they're anticipating that I'm the one who is going to bring this on. And so he shares with them a parable. And in the parable, it's about a certain man who was born into royalty, and he went to a distant land to receive his kingdom and then return. So he goes away. But before he goes away, he calls together a bunch of his servants. Now, who are servants? What are servants? You know, we have jobs, right? And we have contracts. Well, a servant also has a job and a contract. But what is the contract to do? So the will of the master, right? It's to take care, you serve the master, right? So he calls his servants together, a number of them, and he gives them the equivalent of it's, you know, a denarii, I think it says. In this translation here, it says, gives them money worth 4 months' wages. So if we put it into today's term, depending on whether you're on minimum wage or where you are, say it's 5,000 bucks. He gives each one 5,000 bucks. And they all know he's going to go away. Now, thanks to Steve's question, I started digging in this book and realized that he actually dedicates a chapter to this story. And he challenges the typical interpretation of this story. And I don't have time to spend much time on it, but what he does is he calls them and he's going to go to a distant land. They know he's going to be leaving. He calls together 10 servants and gave each of them money for worth 4 months' wages. He said, do business with this until I return. Now, what does that mean to you? Whose business are they doing? His business, right? So they're going out and they're to do his business. Now, it becomes important because immediately after this, do business with this until I return. What's the next line? The citizens hated him. The plot thickens. The plot thickens. Because what has he done? He's given 4 months' wages to all these different people, and he said, go out and do business in my name. You know? So if you're selling carpet, it's not, you know, John's carpet shop. No, it's King what's his name's famous carpets, you know? So you're doing business in the name of this guy whose citizens hate him. So what's happening here? I just assumed the guy with the third person. So he goes away, he gets his kingdom, he comes back, and he asks for the report. And when he asks for the report, he says, after receiving his kingdom, he returned, called the servants to whom he had given the money to find out how much they had earned. You know, what did you do with your business? What did you bring in for me? The first servant came forward and said, your money has earned a return of 1,000%. So you gave me 5,000, I'm returning, what's 1,000%? Is it 50,000? 500,000? That's a quick return. So he says this. The king replied, excellent. You are a good servant because you have been faithful. Not because you've earned all this money for me. It's because you've been faithful. Why does he say faithful? Why would he say faithful? Remember, everybody hates him. His citizens hate him. But yet, this man received the talents, went out, put it to work in the name of this soon-to-be ruler. Even in a context of hatred and strife, he did business in his name. So who was he faithful to? The one who gave him the money. He didn't say, you're going to be rewarded because of what you earned. No, it's because of your faithfulness. Second person, same thing. Third person, what happens? He said, I know that you reap where you don't sow. I know that you take what doesn't belong to you. So what did I do? I buried it. And so now I'm giving back to you what you gave to me. The king says, ha, you could have at least put it in the bank and gained interest. So he takes away that $1,000, say, that he was given, or 500, and, or 5,000, I said, not sorry, that 5,000 he was given, he takes that away and he gives it to the person who returned with 1,000 times as much. Then the story continues. He said, give it to the person with 10 times as much. He replied, I say to you that everyone who has been given more, everyone who has will be given more. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. And then he says this phrase, as for my enemies who don't want me as their king, bring them here and slaughter them before me. Now, that seems like just a brutal phrase. But think about it once. For the longest time, I was thinking, okay, well, what's going on here is this is sort of a sandwich there because you've got Zacchaeus who meets Jesus, encounters salvation, and what he does is economic justice, right? Then in the next chapter, it's Jesus coming in, or next, the last story, it's Palm Sunday, Jesus is going in, to the temple, And he chases the sellers out because this is a house of prayer. You've turned it into a place of commerce. It's supposed to be a house of prayer. And when he was told to make the crowd quiet, all these people that are shouting out to him, he says, the Pharisees say, quiet him down. They shouldn't be making so much noise about you. Jesus says, if I silence them, the rocks will begin to shout out. So Jesus is, in a sense, is claiming sovereignty over all things, right? He says, all of creation is mine. And so you can't contain creation. Even if I stop these people from talking, you can't stop it there. So Jesus is positioning himself. That's what I'm thinking, right? Well, then I read this guy, Kenneth Bailey, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. And he says, you know, for the early hearers of this story, they were in a bargaining culture. So in a bargaining culture, what happens? Are there prices on things? Sometimes, sometimes not. So you say, how much is this mug? I can't find the price. What's the guy say? He says, oh, it's $20. And then what do you say in response? Jackie, is it five? Okay, so one says 10, one says five. So it's a bargaining culture. It's a bargaining culture. So how does that influence how we look at what's going on in this story? It's a bargaining culture. And what happens, you know, in our culture, he uses this kind of illustration. He says, in this culture, somebody's told to clear out your desk and you're fired today. Clear out your desk, get out of the office by 5 p.m. What do? Pack up and go. But in a bargaining culture, what do? You bargain. You bargain. I had an experience like this in Ghana. We were told by the church in Ghana, there were three couples and one single woman, so seven mission workers and there were five children and three couples and the single woman. We were told to that we want nothing to do with any more mission workers. You're all to leave. Okay? Now, I took that as being fired. Now, I was the youngest member on the team, but I was the one they trusted the most in many ways to say this. So they said it to me. I said, okay, fine. Left that meeting, went home. I called my boss and I said, they asked us to leave. They asked us all to leave. He said, well, did they give a time frame? I said, yes, sort of, because they weren't asking us to leave immediately. We are all finishing terms over the next 8 months. And so in the process of the conversation, I took it as a given that we're fired. But I did ask, are you wanting us to leave right away? Like, is it as of today you're fired, you're finished? Or is it, can we finish the school year for the kids? Can we do this? Can we do this? He said, yes, certainly. No. So fine. There was a bargaining sense in that. But when I came back to the church leaders and said, well, last night I called our director and he agreed to the negotiations that you've requested on because they were wanting to for the agency to make available funds directly to the church for certain projects, et cetera. And so they were happy, in a sense, to hear that the director had accepted this as part of a bargaining conversation. But they were very unhappy with me that I had actually told him that we were being asked, all of us, to leave, and the time frame. Because for them, even that was negotiable. Because they weren't really saying, you have to leave. Okay? So what Bailey does with this is he takes the fact that at the end of this story, he said, as for my enemies, you don't want me as their, who don't want me as their king, bring them here and slaughter them before me. What's missing in this story? Nobody likes the king, but what's missing? Do we actually hear in the parable that the people were brought before Jesus and or before the king and they were all executed? No. And then it gets you thinking about what about that story about the wayward sons? You know, the prodigal son going off and spending, and then the second son comes out and he's all upset with the father, and the father says, you know, you're invited to come in. Come in and join us. You don't hear if he joins or not. In a lot of Jesus's parables, you don't hear the conclusion. It's lacking an end. And so in a bargaining context, Bailey says here, you know, if we accept that Jesus is actually this royal person who gets the kingdom, it's a contradiction of who Jesus is for him to execute these people. And Bailey says, but it doesn't say that they were actually executed. It says they were to be brought before him for execution, but it doesn't say that they go on to be executed. And so the point is that this story in the middle here also is, just as the Zacchaeus story is one that talks about the immediacy of the reign of God and economic justice there, the second story talks about the generosity of God and the free giving. And there's actually a test built into this story. Will you do commerce in my name? And the two did commerce in the name of the master. The third one buried it. And so part of what's happening in the story is, when times get rough, will you stand up for me? Will you do business in my name? And so the ones who get condemned are the ones who are not willing to serve the king. But we can't say that they were really executed. So we get into this next story, and I'm just going to wrap it up quickly here. There's the first little bit where Jesus goes in on a colt. Now, what's the problem with a colt? It didn't belong to him. Well, okay. It's probably young and untrained, but Jesus, that's the one he wants. But if you're gonna take over Jerusalem, would you do it on a donkey? No. What would you do? Yeah, you'd have a horse, at least some kind of horse, and you'd parade with many horses. But Jesus, how does this come about? He gets a wild donkey. Now, again, it's one of these stories here where, you know, we're, as the reader, we've got secret information in a sense. Because the people in the parade don't know that this is a wild, wild donkey. They didn't know. But what Jesus is doing, though, he gets this wild donkey that the owner might have been saying, not maybe wasn't questioning at all them taking the donkey, making use of the donkey. But maybe his question was, do you know what kind of wild ass this is? You know? Nobody's come close to sitting on this thing. And yet what happens? They put cloaks on it, set Jesus on it, and everything's cool. Jesus rides into Jerusalem, and there's no uproar. The only uproar is over Jesus, but it's not over, he can't control this donkey. And then what happens next? They say, tell the crowd to be quiet. And Jesus says, didn't you see this donkey I'm on? This is a wild donkey, and I'm on it. Don't you know that even the rocks will shout out praise to me? So in a sense, you can say Jesus is demonstrating that his power is a different kind of power. And then when he gets into Jerusalem, he weeps over the city. So he doesn't shout victory over conquest. No, he weeps because the city has fallen away from God's glory. And then he goes to the temple and he clears the temple because why? It's to be a house of prayer. And as you may recall from last year, telling this story, I don't think we did it from Luke last year, but what was the area of the temple that Jesus was being used for commerce? If you look at this map at the back of this Bible here, the first maps are of the temple, of Jerusalem in the temple. And it shows where the altar is. And then the courtyard, when you come right in, just where you come in there, it says, courtyard of Gentiles. Who are the Gentiles? The non-Jews. So the hoi polloi, like Warwick River people, this is our entry point. The part of the temple that was reserved for non-Jews was filled with people selling. And so our place in the temple was being occupied by sellers. So what Jesus was doing when he cleared the temple was to say, this is a space of prayer for all people. And you're taking it over for commerce. So he was simply making room for the house of prayer to be a house of prayer for all people. There are a lot of different things. I've got 1 minute here to pull this a bit together. And the thing is, we are called to serve a God, the God of all people, of all creation. This story demonstrates that the rocks can cry out. It demonstrates that even over things like a donkey, Jesus coming into contact with Jesus, even the people that Jesus sent, the animal was calm for. And they come and he rides it. He rides it into. So it's not a triumphal entry, as we call it. It's really a very modest and humble entry. And then when he goes into the temple, it's not to take over the temple and turn it into something for him. No, it's to reclaim the space for all people. And so the challenge for us in our faithfulness to God is how do we leave our hearts and minds open to all people? How do we make space if our bodies are a temple, if our bodies are a place of encounter with God, if our homes are places of encounter with God, how are we making room for all people? How are we living out God's reconciling love, not just for our own, but for all people? And for me, that's the most powerful part of this story, of this series of stories. Let's pray. God of grace and mercy, thank you for your word, which comes to us anew in so many ways, so many days, so many times. I thank you for giving me the strength to make it through this, to have the energy to be on my feet. I pray, Lord, that you will be with our world and that you will call us in our hearts and minds to make room for the stranger, to make room for the enemy, to make room for those whom you have called to follow you. And we know, Lord, that you are the God of all of creation. So, Lord, our faithfulness is not, you know, you're not satisfied just with our faithfulness. You want the whole world to be drawn to yourself. Help us, Lord, to be faithful and not simply give reports on what we've accomplished. Help us to be faithful to you and to your service. In Jesus Christ we pray. Amen.